Those of you cultured in a lab and those of you who are born free right here in the real world and not in the Matrix. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, the most scumbaggery experienced and absolutely fantastically on the fly radio show to exist in the world ever. And if you don't believe me, don't worry, you're probably part of the majority of humanity who won't believe anything they're told, even if it leads to their extermination. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com, this is the most fabulous radio network because there are no taboo topics. Unlike the New Zealand media and the American media and the Australian media, in fact, it's just media in general. And nowadays, those people who want to tell other sides of particular stories don't wind up getting their stories told. Why? Because the people who broadcast them are too chicken of getting sued or arrested or harangued or something like that, or having their income threatened. Whereas, conveniently, I have no income, so there's nothing to threaten. Yep. It's amazing what risks you'll take when you've got nothing to lose, isn't it? Now, my very special guests, and there's a plural there for a reason, is Kent Parker and Vic Perkis. If you haven't heard of them, you probably, you're probably just like most of the other people in this world who don't get to listen or see or hear anything that's decent and well-informed. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Benny.
Good morning.
Now, allegedly the topic of discussion is the David Bain murder. But before we get into that, I'd like you two to actually introduce yourselves and just explain to people who you are and how it is you come to get into this particular field. Vic, let's start with you.
Well, I'm a shop assistant enquirer on the Coromandel in New Zealand. And basically what it was I was watching the trial of David Bain on the TV, and there was a few points that sort of struck me that I had to look into it further. And it just didn't look right. So hence, I'm into it up to my knees, or up to my neck, actually. So...
Well, precisely, what
just
are
a normal
you doing?
Person.
Well, precisely, are you doing that you're all up at? Just the David Bain murder trial?
What exactly am I doing?
Yeah.
Well, we have the two websites up and running, one on Facebook, which is called Justice for Robin Bain, and that's what we're trying to do. That's our main aim, is to clear that man's name, who I've never heard a bad word said about in public or from people that knew him. And it just riled me that someone that couldn't defend himself had someone that was supposed to be very close to him just vilify his name all over the world. The man now who had a good life, the man who had a good life and done nothing wrong to anyone, is now being seen as a ogre and a pedophile and an incestuous man by a person that shouldn't allow that type of conversation. So it just angered me.
Well, you'd be surprised how much anger is a motivator. You know, Kent, we'll also go to you then. Kent Parker, ladies and gentlemen, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, hello everyone. I live some distance from Vic. We've done all this over the internet, and I'm a web developer. And when the George Bush declared war on Iraq, my eyes pricked up, and I wanted to do something about it because I could see that there was a massive amount of propaganda going on here. And the same with the Bain case. When the Bain retrial, which was held in 2009, and you'll find out more about this as we go through the show, when the retrial took place, I smelt a rat. I smelt some propaganda, and that's what I'm interested in, and I finally am doing something.
Well, let's back up for a minute here. Just for those who don't know, who exactly is David Bain, and what allegedly happened?
Well, in 1994, on the 20th of June, the Bain family, which consisted of a mother, a father, two sisters, and a younger brother, were all murdered or killed in the early hours of the morning by a 22 rifle. The police were alerted to this by a 111 call, in which the caller claimed, they're all dead, repeatedly. And when the police arrived at the scene, they found five bodies in the house and a computer in the lounge with a sentence, "Sorry, you are the only one who deserved to stay." And the only person left alive was David, the 22-year-old eldest son of the family. Meanwhile, the rifle, which was the killing weapon, lay near the body of David's father in one of the rooms. And all the other bodies were in bedrooms. Obviously, some of them have been killed execution style while they were asleep, and one or two had got out of bed, and the youngest brother had actually struggled violently with the killer, and there was just blood all through his room. So this is a scene that the police came across in 1994. You got anything to any points I've missed, Vic?
Well, one of them was found on the floor as if you'd been praying for her life. I don't think that's a broad outline of that. I mean, as you say, we can get into more of the incriminating evidence as we go along. I'm sure they will arise.
Okay, so what kind of a time frame? Does this happen early in the morning or late at night?
Well, it happened in early hours of the morning before light, because it was 20th of June in New Zealand is midwinter, and
there's only farmers and police raids that get up that early in the morning.
and newspaper boys.
Yeah, newspaper boys. Mm.
Yeah. Which is what David done as for a living. He delivered newspapers.
So he could have probably been out delivering newspapers, and just after he got up and left, somebody else got up or came to the house, something happened?
Well,
and then he comes back.
That's basically what he is saying.
Okay, well, it would be interesting to see what kind of a... He doesn't have any alibis, of course. Nobody's up watching and waiting for the paper to come by that early in the morning, are they?
Well, can I just explain, Vinny, that David claimed that he came home from the morning paper run and, as normal, put on his clothes washer, which is what he normally did, to wash the clothes, and then went upstairs and found his mother and his father dead. And that was his explanation. So his explanation was that the murders happened while he was on the paper run. So the paper run is relevant in that respect. And so when the police turned up, they thought they were investigating a murder-suicide in which the father had killed the family and then himself. But after they gathered the evidence and sifted through and looked at things, they arrested David, and he was tried and convicted the following year and sentenced to 16 years for murder. And they achieved this conviction based on the scenario that David killed his mother and siblings before he went on the paper run. And then...
Whoa, hold on a second. Why would somebody kill the family and then go, you know what, I think I better go to work now. You know, people might think something's amiss.
Well, the idea was to use the paper run as an alibi so that he could come back and say, I was on my paper run and that's my alibi, I didn't do it.
Well, here's the question. Were the papers delivered or not?
Oh, yeah, everything was delivered as normal. So it was a good alibi. But he had
nobody to corroborate his alibi, did he?
Well,
because nobody was awake
to make sure a couple of people.
There were a couple of people that saw him do it.
Yes, there was one person that saw him at a gate. There was another lady that actually asked him a few weeks before not to enter her property to deliver the newspaper because it disturbed her dog, or it was too early in the morning for him and woke him up. So he'd done that. Mm. He did deliver it to their gate as per the request. But on that particular morning, she recalls him coming into her property to deliver the newspaper. There was another lady that saw him at his gate. That's another, which is a bit of a more complicated story. That lady was on her way to work, and she thought she was late for work because she saw him at his gate when usually she sees him a few hundred metres up the road. So she thought she was late for work.
So he was late for work?
She was late for work. She thought she was late for work because she saw him in a position that was much further down the road than she usually sees him.
Hmm.
So there was a, you know, they were...
So, I mean, did she think she was late for work, or was she actually late for work, or was he just much earlier?
No, she was not late for work when she got there. He was. It looked to her like he was ahead of time when she got to work.
Yeah.
So, there's also two stories that he told as well. There's a story that he told to three people, actually. No, there's a story... He talked to two old school friends many years ago about he could use his paper run round as an alibi to kidnap a jogger. Though their evidence was suppressed at trial as being too prejudicial.
So what if David Bain purposely sped up doing his paper route? Did it really, really quick? So it would look like he'd done his paper route and whatever, and quickly get home, execute his family before his paper route would normally be finished, hence the perfect alibi.
No, the prosecution case was that he killed the family before he went on the paper run. So then his paper run was normal, and then he got home and was waiting for his father, who was sleeping in a caravan next to the house. He wasn't sleeping in the house. His father got up, and their case was that he waited for him to come into the house, and that's when he shot the father. So that was the prosecution case, and he was tried and convicted on the basis of that. And there were lots and lots of bits of evidence which supported it. And
a lot of evidence gets thrown out. It's hearsay, or it's inadmissible, or whatever the legal fiction dogma that it is. There's sometimes in court where relevant evidence is simply ignored. Do you know of any pieces of evidence like that?
Well, in this case, this evidence wasn't ignored. It was in court. It's all circumstantial, but it all adds up to the same. There are about 20 items of evidence, I don't know, including things like David's fingerprints in blood were on the murder weapon, in blood. And the gun belonged to David.
Did he have any residue on his fingers of discharged munition?
No, because someone had a shower and his hands were clean. So that there was no residue to be had because he'd had a shower since he'd done it. There was an empty cartridge lying on its edge by the deceased father's hand.
Magazine, Ken. Magazine.
Oh, magazine. Okay.
How many rounds in the magazine?
Well, I can't recall. I don't know if that's...
Probably only five or seven. Five or seven's only was legal in this country, I think.
Yeah. The rifle had a trigger lock, and that had been unlocked using a spare key, and the only person who knew where that was kept was David. Now, a pair of glasses was found in the murder scene. The lens from the glasses was found in the younger brother's room where the fight had taken place, and the rest of the glasses were found on a chair in David's room. And these broken glasses, although they weren't David's, they were ones that he habitually wore when his own weren't available. His own glasses were at the optometrist at the time. So the glasses were there. They were broken. They were ones that David wore. He had injuries on his face, which were consistent with the glasses having been whacked off during the struggle in the younger brother's room. And David had shown a female friend a few days later some scratches on his torso, which he couldn't explain.
Mm.
And also in the younger brother's room was a pair of gloves. They were covered in blood, blood-soaked gloves, and these also belong to David, and it is assumed that whoever fought with the younger brother was wearing the gloves and tore them off in order to fight more effectively.
And
they were discarded in the room.
Was the brother shot, or was he stabbed, or killed in some other way, or was he shot?
No, they were all shot. But the
they were all shot. Because so if they... all right, well, we'll have to get into more of this after the break, ladies and gentlemen. There's the music. It's that time. A nice little cliffhanger, incidentally. We'll be right back at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We'll be back in just a minute.
I got some so-called friends, smile right to my face. All when my back is turned, they like to bury me without a trace. Oh no, no. Oh no, no. There's only one thing I need to know. Who's that? Are you? Flying a JFK.
Welcome back.
My heart goes boom, boom, boom.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Also, iFinity FM network in Southland, Rush FM in Hamilton, and a few internet radio stations as well. Truth News Radio, Wolf Spirit Radio, TNS Radio, Ireland there. And you know, places all over the States, real radio stations. Hi, guys. You know, we're broadcasting live from the future. We're from New Zealand. It's all ready tomorrow. So you can be assured that we're going to give you the most up-to-date news. My very special guests are Kent Parker and Vic Purgis. Now, we left on a bit of an edge this last segment, and it seems to me that if you're going to have a wee bit of a fight or a scuffle, then your gloves get taken off, then you wind up with blood all over your hands because you're busy murdering somebody, for instance, and then you wind up with your bloody fingerprints on the murder weapon, and you place it next to the guy who you're trying to pin it on, and you don't even try and make sure that his fingerprints are on it, you know? And then you have a shower, of course. Now, if anybody's in a murder situation where you just came home and accidentally saw your entire family murdered, you know, obviously, you know, the first thing that you're going to do in a massive grief-stricken panic is wash off any evidence.
Yeah, well,
and the other thing is, all the bloody clothes were in the washing machine. I'd been gone through the washing machine.
And his story was he came home from his paper route and put his clothes into the washing machine as normal. Does he normally come home after dispensing copies of the local rag covered in blood?
Apparently.
Does he deliver papers to the local chicken slaughtering factory of some description, you know? Come on.
Ken.
Sorry,
yeah,
Ken.
Anyway, Vinny, we're in the middle of... There's a lot of circumstantial evidence, which the judge in the first trial said made up the strands to a rope, which directed towards David being responsible for the murders. And we've already had his fingerprints on the rifle. It was his gun. He was the only one who knew where the lock, the key was for the lock. Glasses that he wore were found in the middle of the murder scene. He had injuries on his face. His bloodied gloves were found in the murder scene. He's a strong young man, and he was considerably stronger than his father. And in addition, we haven't covered this yet, he had blood on his clothes when the police found him, which belonged to Stephen. Now, these were only tiny specks, so one would assume that without his glasses, he couldn't see these specks. So he didn't think that the clothes that he was wearing had any blood on them, but there were spots of blood on his clothes. And, of course, the only person who would have got blood off would have been the younger brother, Stephen, because of the fight. So he had blood on him from the younger brother, and there were blood marks on the doorway consistent with someone of his height. And there's all this circumstantial evidence, which was more evidence than you get in most murder trials. You know, so many people get locked up because of some witness testimonies saying, oh, I saw him there. But there was no way that you could exclude David from being near the murder scene on that morning. He had this alibi with the paper run, but he could have done the murders before the paper run and then done the paper run and then come home and killed his father. And so he was convicted. 16 years.
Well, the thing is, if he killed the rest of them, wouldn't it have woken up the father? You know, we are talking about the use of a rifle here. What caliber was it?
It was a 22, but it had a silencer.
Oh, 22's not that loud, eh?
And the father was sleeping in a caravan outside.
And it had a silencer, you say?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Have you ever done any shooting? Yeah.
A little bit.
Why would you commit suicide with a silencer on the rifle?
Yeah. I just want to kill myself, but I don't want to disturb the neighbours.
Yeah, well, can I run through the scenario of where they say that Robin was supposed to commit this crime?
It's like Robin at this point, how can there be one?
Well, this is the story from the defence. Robin was sleeping in a caravan at the bottom of this section. I'm just laying it out in layman's terms, so excuse me if it sounds too simple. But Robin was sleeping in the caravan at the back of the section. Now,
Robin's
according to the defence, Robin was sleeping in a caravan at the bottom of the section. Robin was supposed to have woken up, gone up to the letterbox, got the newspaper out of the letterbox, gone into the house, put the newspaper on the dressing table, gone into David's room to find his rifle, which he knew where the rifle was, but according to David Bain, no one else knew where the trigger lock key was. So he had to find the trigger lock key, which was in a jar on David's dressing table, containing a load of knickknacks, pens and things like that, with a ball on the top of it. And someone, to find that key, you had to take the ball off of the jar and rummage for it to find the key, then put the ball back on top of the jar, then first of all go and shoot his wife, then, and I'm not quite sure of the order, but then shot Stephen, who had a massive fight with. The first bullet just went through Stephen's hand and grazed his head. He had a massive fight with him, and he ended up, Robin was supposed to have strangled his son with a T-shirt to incapacitate him and then shot him through the head. This sounds horrible, doesn't it? Then shoots the sister, the youngest sister, then goes downstairs and shoots the other sister, who was on her knees, according to the position of her body, probably praying for her life, on her knees. Then went upstairs, and here's a good part, then go out to the caravan and change his clothes to get rid of the blood to meet his maker. Then go inside, type the message on the computer, you are the only one that deserved to stay, which was in the past tense. Robin Bain was an English teacher, apart from anything else. And then in a convoluted position, shoot yourself through the head. And on top of that, the autopsy, and I'm going to say this, he was found to have 400 mils of urine, concentrated urine in his bladder. Now, I had a look on Wikipedia yesterday, and the bladder, the scenario, what I came up with on off of Wikipedia, was a human bladder holds, there was one site that said it holds between 300 and 350, and another site that says it holds 400. So to me, that sounds like a full bladder. Now, I don't know how long that scenario I just told you takes, but I would have had to go to the loo apart from anything else.
And you got that off Wikipedia, eh? I call that a wiki.
No, all that, like, I only got the urine part off of the Wikipedia. So wiki, I could have got it off a WikiLeak, as you say, but it came off of Wikipedia.
Yeah.
But it just sounds...
So suffice to say, somebody with a completely full bladder, you know, it's just like... When I need to murder somebody, I do go and take a nice leak first, you know. It just releases all that pressure.
Hey, Vinny, I put that out of my head, that full bladder part, simply because I've heard people say that some bladders hold that and hold that. But what it done was make me look at everything else. And everything else, there's none of it. I can't find anything that actually proves that Robin Bain done it, apart from what people say, the defence have said. You know, there's no blood on him.
How was Robin Bain actually killed? He was shot. He was shot where? In the head.
In the left temple.
He's a right hander.
And
research has shown that only 3% of people shoot themselves through the wrong temple, and with a silencer on. If you look at the photographs on our website of the position that he was supposed to be in, which is counterspin.co.nz. If you look at the position that he was supposed to have shot himself in, you know,
he would have had to have been like a yoga instructor.
Well, yeah. I mean, it would have been much easier to take the silencer off the rifle and have done with it.
Yeah. I mean, look, why bother doing your stretching exercises when you could just pretend to shoot yourself in the wrong temple each day? It would provide you with much greater increased flexibility and also will help you out if you're ever accused of, murder or whatever, because people will obviously think you did it.
And it would also have helped to exonerate the only one that deserved to stay, because, you know, why would his father, who thought that the only one that was deserved to stay, leave so much evidence against that man?
Well, let's think about motive here. I mean, what would Robin Bain's motive have been? I mean, I don't think was there any real problem in the family at all recently or what have you?
There were some problems in the family, as there are in most families. And can I just for those people who aren't familiar with the case, which is most of your listeners, the ones in America anyway, that David Bain was originally convicted of these crimes, but then, and this was back in 1995, but since then, a person has crusaded on his behalf and wrote three books now, and managed to get a retrial, which was held in 2009, on the basis of supposedly new evidence. And the result of the retrial was that David Bain was found not guilty, and the argument was that Robin Bain had committed the murders. And this is to explain why Vic is talking about Robin Bain. Robin Bain, being the father, was accused, or is now accused, of committing these murders. And David Bain has served 13 years in prison as a result of the first conviction, and so now we are actively supporting justice for Robin Bain. The purpose why we are talking here is because we want to see Robin Bain, the father, exonerated from what we consider to be false and malicious accusations being made about him, purely as an opportunistic means to get somebody off crime, basically. So,
well, with what purpose? I mean, the only scenarios like that I've found is if the person in question has knows some secrets about the person who they're blackmailing into defending them. I mean, it's not like he had any money or anything like that, is it? But in terms of motive, let's say instead of the motive for David Bain killing his family, what about the motive for an individual defending him and trying to get him off? I mean, what do they really have to gain from that whole thing? I mean, how much work did they have to put in? How much finance versus how much they are planning to get out of it? What's their history? Who are they? What are their connections?
You mean the people who supported David?
Yeah.
Well, it's mainly one person, Joe Karam, who is an ex-All Black and a business entrepreneur. And he's put a considerable amount of money and time into his campaign, but he also has earned considerable amounts. The first book he wrote sold 30,000 copies, which in New Zealand is bestseller. The second book sold well as well, and the third book has just gone out on sale last week. And in addition to that, after the trial, after the retrial in 2009, we discovered that he'd claimed over $400,000 in fees and disbursements through legal aid, which is taxpayer money, to pay for his own work in getting evidence together, expert witnesses and what have you, to fight his battle to get David Bain.
Have you ever heard of any legal aid lawyer getting anywhere near 400K?
Ah, but he's not a lawyer. That's what makes it even more questionable.
Is he not even a member of the Bar Association?
No. He was paid as a member of the team, the Bain defence team, under the supervision of one of the chief lawyer. He was paid $75 and $95 an hour as a layperson. He's got no qualifications in law or any kind of area related to the court, and his only experience in law is as a lay advocate for David Bain, which he has done obsessively since 1996, when he first cottoned on to it.
Are they teaching All Blacks legalese these days? You know, and you're going to go here, and you're going to submit to the bar, and you're going to go into the court, and you're going to make sure that you balance out the equations and say all this stuff. You know, blah. I don't think that's going to get you a try. But then again, we'll never know, will we? Because he's not going to play rugby again, because he seems to be playing a different game. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Billy Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, where if you think you got rights, think again. It's clean and it's green, just like the new Nazis. And my very special guests today are Kent Parker and Vic Perkis. Welcome back, gentlemen. And we're talking about the David Bain murder trials. Way back in the day, like early 90s or whatever, dude, David Bain killed his entire family, blood on him, blood on the murder weapon. It's kind of like the O.J. Simpson of New Zealand, if you will. But he conveniently had a alibi called a paper route, right? yeah, I was throwing newspapers. I couldn't have possibly brutally murdered my entire family. Now, let's talk about motive again. What were David's motives? What kind of stuff was happening on in the family that would have actually made him and motivate him to kill them all? I mean, something serious must have been having to go down if that was the case.
Well, the family did have some dysfunction, you know, like most families do. And the father was sleeping in the caravan because there was some discord in the marital relationship. And in fact, the mother was quite dysfunctional and was not employed and didn't do the housework much, if ever. The house was a mess. Things just lay about and rotted, basically. And she would spend all morning in bed, most of her time, a lot of time in bed, and she would make, she was into occultism, and she'd make decisions with a pendulum. So the mother wasn't very functional, but the father was working full-time as a teacher, and he actually had to commute to a rural school during the week and came home at the weekends. And that kind of left a vacuum in the house that David kind of filled. And he did the role of the man of the house. And he was controlling, and he, well, there's hearsay evidence that he followed the girls around when they went on social events. That he was always trying to, he always wanted to know where they were, and controlling and manipulative stuff like that. And in 2001, Joe Karen published this booklet, and in the booklet was a quote from David Bain, and it had words to the effect that he was betrayed by the ones that he held most dear. And we can only interpret that the ones that he most held dear as being his family. So we reckon that he probably felt betrayed by his family, because they'd actually asked, the parents had asked him to leave home, to go and make his own way in the world, which is, you know, a fairly normal thing. He was 22. His only job was on a paper run, which is like the kind of thing you do when you're 13 or 14. And he'd had a year at university where he'd failed every subject. Then he'd gone on the dole for a year. He'd turned down jobs that had been offered, the dole being the unemployment benefit. And basically, his parents wanted to help him to grow up, I guess. And we reckon that he felt betrayed by this.
Well, let's think about the psyche of a psychopath. Now, they're known to be manipulative, bit of a control freak, egotistical, and they usually have the same cause of it, which is a lack of nurturing or proper parental guidance and relationships, usually due to an absentee father or a crazy mother. And in this case, we have all of that right in a neat little package. So thinking about that, has David undergone any psychological testing to test whether or not he's actually a clinically diagnosable psychopath with a lack of empathy, emotion?
Well, firstly, there's no clinical diagnosis of psychopath. It's just jargon, really. But any psychiatric counseling he has had, of course, is client privileged. So there's nothing's been published, but I don't think you need to be a psychopath to do this kind of thing. It's not a. That's my opinion. Vic, what do you think?
Well, I think you do, but that's,
well, you know, if psychopaths represent a very small percentage of the population, anywhere between 1% and 4%, most of the time you'd never even notice. You know, if you're in a movie theater, there's 200-300 people there, you could be sitting there with between 1 and 12 psychopaths.
But yeah, but it's not as clinical. It's not a clinical term. It's something, sure, psychologists might use it, but it's not actually. It's just a description, really.
Well, there are certain characteristics which are pretty straightforward, like the lighting up areas of the brain in response to emotional stimuli. A normal person, their brain will be lighting up all the place with the reds, the orange, the yellow, that kind of thing across the entire brain spectra. And yet a psychopath will virtually only be active in the very kind of rear base of the brain, the reptilian part of the brain, and the rest of it is sort of like blue with very, very little activity. So there is a physiological definition that is quite sound to do with psychopaths that I don't think can be wrought off to just mere opinion. There's of course a testing scale. They have, I think they did a test on what they call the corporate psychopath on a recent film called I Am Fishhead, and it said that up to a scale of say 25 or over out of a scale of I think about 30, you know, 25 or over means you've definitely got very psychopathic tendencies, and below then it's kind of a little bit iffy. So you have to really do an awful lot and exert many characteristics which are commonly associated with psychopaths before you could even conceive of diagnosing them. But what we've just heard today about the methodical, fairly thorough sort of thing, the brutality of the murder, the foreplanning of it, you know, a whole bunch of stuff sort of fits very much into that type of mentality.
Yeah, I don't entirely agree with the psychopath thing, but I will have to say that David Bain has basically been muzzled by Joe Karam since Karam took over in the case in 1996. In the retrial, he did not testify in his defence. He's in New Zealand, you're allowed to not testify in your defence, and in addition, the jury is instructed not to view that as prejudicial to the defendant. So he didn't talk then, and he hasn't spoken to the media except in a very kind of Mills and Boone fashion to women's magazines. There has never been, and nor was there in the quote in the publication that I just quoted from before, any expression of sorrow or sadness for the loss of his family, or any expression of anger at his father for allegedly doing it. It's just been nothing. So, but
that's because, again, it really does sound like a psychopath to me. They have no conscience, no empathy, nothing like that. They know that things that they're doing are wrong. That's why they try to cover up for it. But they don't actually feel like another person would feel. They don't actually react like another person would react. They see people having these emotional responses and things like that, and they go home and practice in the mirror and try and mimic what that response is. You know, this sort of thing. Highly overactive minds and just holding a pin on the rest of humanity. Very antisocial. Not having a terribly large amount of social skills. Bullying, conniving, set people up, stab them in their back, that kind of thing, to ensure that they're the one who advances and everybody else is kept down and seen as a threat.
Yeah, well, I would agree with some of those things, the lack of social skills. But because he's never spoken, or hasn't since 1996, then Joe Karam has been able to use him as a blank canvas to paint a picture of an innocent, nice, congenial young man whose career as a opera singer was rudely cut short and so on and so forth. So he's kind of, Joe Karam spoken on his behalf. And so we haven't heard from the real David Bain, so we've got no idea who the real David Bain really is.
There's a new TV show out now. It's kind of like American Idol. It's called The Voice, right? It's going on in the UK right now. It's very interesting. It's different from the other types of TV shows like this, where they don't actually get to see the person who sings at all, and they get to judge him just on the voice alone. Just like Joe Karam is painting a picture and singing the song sheet for David Bain, and nobody gets to see who he really is.
Yeah, well, I'd agree with that, yep.
Very interesting.
The picture we get of David Bain is what Joe tells us about a nice boy, a nice steady job and all that, but no one knows, apart from some of the people in the school, of course.
Yeah, I mean, look at, for example, politicians. You know, they're rude, they're corrupt, they engage in untold quantities of scumbaggery. But the PR people that they've got working for them are lovely people. They've got smiles, they appear interested in what you have to say, they act like they care, they don't lie blatantly through their teeth because they don't know what they're reading out is a lie from a teleprompter. So you don't really see the real full picture when what you've got basically is somebody reporting to you something that somebody else has told them, and they haven't even looked into it really at all whatsoever. And thus, the perception of the general public about virtually everything that goes on our society, their view becomes askew, don't they? They have no perception of reality because they never get the opportunity to see reality. Don't you get it, people? They lie to you. They manipulate you, just like a psychopath would. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. Coming up after the break, more about the David Bain case. We're going to wrap this up in a neat little package. Back in a minute. Delete the virus, alert the masses. Back, ladies and gentlemen, it is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, broadcasting live from New Zealand, live from the future. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. As Jack Blood says, the best network of any size in the world. Because the people behind the scenes are really nice and the quality's really high and all the subjects and hosts are really cool. Basically. Give props to the other hosts, you know. They deserve it probably more than I do. My very special guests are Kent Parker and Vic Perkis. And it's like, guys, can we actually get your websites as well? Because I think that might be decent enough. If people are listening in and what have you, they can then go and check up those websites and get some decent information or what have you.
Yeah, okay. Well, now might be a good time to point out that because we've spoken out about this case and come up with arguments that counter what Joe Karam has put forward, Mr. Karam has taken it upon himself to sue us for defamation. And so Vic and I together are now defendants in this, what we consider to be an improper and vexatious lawsuit against us. Now, if we were American citizens and in America, we would have been protected by the First Amendment. But here in New Zealand, we have a more punitive defamation system, and the law courts are allowed to indulge this kind of defamation suit. And
have you heard of the case of Vince Seema by chance?
Seema?
Yeah, Vince Seema, kiwisfirst.co.nz. He's basically New Zealand's top watchdog against corruption and what have you. And back in the day, Michael Stiassny sold one of his companies out from under it, liquidated it without his permission, and then stole all the money. And because Stiassny had contacts, and basically he knew a lot of the lawyers in the system, and a lot of the judges were his former lawyers, that kind of thing, he did a defamation suit against Vince Seema with zero evidence, right? And when they went to go judge him, like two out of the three judges were Stiassny's former lawyers. And Vince Seema got up and says, look, I think we can dismiss these two judges and get two more, if you please, because of perceived conflict of interest. And they said, no, continue.
I might have vaguely heard of it, but
But our judiciary is corrupt, is what I'm saying. So it invariably favours those with connections. And I'm acting under the assumption that because Joe Karam's been through an enormous fucking trial that was successful and dished out a heck of a lot of money for a bunch of people in suits and wigs and scarves and what have you, that he's got a lot of connections too.
Yeah, well, it comes down to money. And they often say defamation is the 21st century form of the duel. You know, where two aristocrats met at dawn with a pistol or a couple of swords. And normally it's people with lots of money who take part in these things. But Vic and I, we're just normal, ordinary Kiwis, and we don't have lots of money, but we have a legal representative who is available to us at a much cheaper rate than you normally find in the marketplace. And we've got a donate button at counterspin.co.nz, we've already had plenty of donations, and but we any further donations are appreciated, because as well, if you don't know, defending your freedom of expression in a lawsuit like this is a very expensive process, and we intend
and time consuming and yeah. stressful.
Well, I don't know about stress, but time consuming.
Wait a minute.
Okay, you ask Vic about the stress. You don't have to say anything.
Oh god, this is going to be good. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just standing on the chair with a rope around my neck as we speak, actually. But otherwise, it's okay.
Yeah. So if he drops off here, ladies and gentlemen, you know why.
I tell you what, I won't do, though. I won't use a 22 rifle with a silencer on it.
Yeah,
I'll find easier way.
Yeah. I mean, but if you do go that route, make sure you take your yoga class that morning. Apparently, it helps.
I'll blame it on you, Vinny.
Yeah. I traveled like 400 kilometers round trip to just come and murder you, and then just kicked off back home and say that I was doing my radio show.
That's it. Well, you can drop some of our flyers off on your way then.
Yeah.
I can't cover the whole country.
Yeah, I'll do a letterbox drop. You know, one in each town as I pass by. You know, I'm sure there'll only be the odd New Zealand wino stumbling around the old streets of Tokoroa or something like that at that time of the morning.
Mm. Well, that when you say a letterbox drop, that's exactly what we're having to do. We haven't got the money to do what the defence have done, and that's used the press paid for TV advertising. We haven't got those resources. What we're having to do, and there's a, you know, we've got a lot of members on our websites. What we're having to do is print off flyers and just drop them in letterboxes, exactly as you say, or underneath windscreens. You know, we've got to get down to pounding the streets to do it. You know, where we haven't got the resources of David Bain, that David Bain has got behind him.
Joe Karam. Well, see, David Bain doesn't seem to have any resources at all. It just seems all about Joe Karam.
I can't. We're already being sued for defamation. I mean, this is another thing. We're having to be careful what we say. You know.
See, this is the problem that I have when your freedom of speech is threatened by scumbags. Basically,
well, we're not the first.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
We're not the first, and we won't be the last either. There's a long list of people that have been threatened with defamation in this case. They started off...
How big's that list?
Well, I could probably reel off six people out of my head now, you know? I mean, and it's probably longer than that. Sorry?
Frank, that's really... That's a long list of people being threatened with defamation. I wonder why. What's his interest? I have a suspicious mind, and I believe a suspicious mind is a healthy mind. What motive does Joe Karam have, financial or otherwise, to stop people telling the other side of the story?
I'll answer that one. My opinion is that he wants other opposing arguments to be shut out of discussion. And that my opinion is that he's he's suing us because he doesn't want our message to get across. And I was really pissed off to find out that he sued a major newspaper simply for writing a story about us. And that this is a case which is currently in process. So there are two cases at least in process now of defamation. And he previously sued somebody for an article on North and South in 2003. He threatened to sue the author of a book who wrote about the Bain case some time ago, and there was a defamation suit against an article on Women's Day several years ago. And we're being sued for comments that were made on Facebook, just on the discussion pages, normal discussion forums. And after we were threatened with the lawsuit, we made that Facebook site private. And yet, 6 months later, when the lawsuit came out, posts from that site were part of the claim, yet it had been private. So we'd taken action. We'd removed the stuff from the public so the public couldn't read it anymore, yet he still went ahead with that particular action. And the other...
Seems rather rather malicious.
Well, it's oppressive is the word you use if you're a legal person. It's a very oppressive defamation suit. And the other was also sued for material on the other website, counterspin.co.nz, which is our public website. Again, that was for comments that people made in lively discussions in the discussion forum.
Where, what?
Yeah. As well as stuff which had been in the editorial items, but most of the
comments... Oh, this is raising more red flags than China, mate.
Well, I think it has huge implications for every message board in the world.
Well,
yeah.
In New Zealand, anyway.
Well, that's fracking incredible, gentlemen. Why go through such an extent? What has he got on the line? What will happen to him if people suddenly realise that David Bain's actually guilty? I mean, what has he got, like, movie deals in the works or something?
Yeah, well, according to Joe, he's talking to movie people. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And and the compensation bid. Now, since the retrial, we're...
Whoa. This is the $400,000 legal aid compensation bid?
No. That was legal aid that he got for work.
He's already got that?
Yeah, he's already got that. Now, this is
compensation for jailing David Bain for like 13 years.
Yeah, it's compensation for wrongful imprisonment, which they have applied for as a result of the retrial verdict in 2009. So they made an application which is being investigated by a Canadian retired judge. And if they get this, it could be anything in the region of $2 million. And we know from Joe Karam himself that he has a 50% deal in any earnings from the David Bain case, and therefore, based on that information, he would get $1 million. So there's
the question is
for him.
Would you seek compensation if it meant you could get $2 million? I would.
You didn't even think about it, Vinny.
I don't have to. It's $2 million. You know, I could bribe God with that and still get into heaven.
Yeah, well, I could publish my own books.
I could finance innumerable defamation cases.
Well, I could buy TV advertising and things like that. You know,
I could buy out a big chunk of Fairfax Media.
Oh, don't mention him. Are they on the other line?
Well, and some Australian mining chief exec chick just bought out a huge chunk of Fairfax Media New Zealand just recently. Why is that? Well, I presume it's probably the same reason why why a big Spanish corporation bought up a whole bunch of magazines and local newspapers in the state of Texas as they were putting the massive gargantuan Trans-Texas Corridor through, confiscating private land, and basically becoming a fracking state of Mexico. So they bought out anybody who would oppose.
Anything to do with that?
Well, this is just a completely random thing. I'm just talking about patterns of behaviour here. If you're going to do something that involves at least an infinitesimal amount of scumbaggery, the best idea is to bribe off the people, or better yet, buy off the people who are going to expose you for it. Either that, or frighten the living Shiite Muslim out of them by threatening anybody who says a fracking thing in free public forums or discussions, or not, so that they won't do anything.
Yeah.
Can I just say, Vinny, that one of the things we're being sued for, of course, is our suggestion that there might be some kind of incentive for Joe Karam in the money that might come from compensation or possible film royalties and what have you from the Bain case. And that's one of the things that we're being sued for, which...
Well, there's only two real reasons why people are doing defamation cases, okay? One is to protect your business, and the other is to protect your reputation, which protects your business, okay? So whatever the heck you're threatening defamation for, if you have any financial interest in it whatsoever, it's a big, big red flag, or at least that's what I think, you know? And that's my personal opinion, because we have freedom of expression in this country, okay, under the Bill of Rights. However... the government and the courts and the police and virtually every single mainstream establishment of any kind, any government agency, or corporate or otherwise, don't seem to recognize that people have rights, don't seem to recognize that they can't just stomp all over everybody, don't seem to recognize that you can't invade people's lives and privacy, don't seem to recognize that you have to honor your word, do what you say you will, and deal with people in a reasonable and decent manner without asking accusatory, incendiary questions or holding an axe over somebody's head to threaten to decapitate them if they so much as open their mouth against you. The government doesn't recognize that. Okay? All they recognize is, here's our agenda, and we're sticking to it. Anybody comes up in opposition, boom. We have the full power of the legal mafia at our disposal.
Yeah, well, that's pretty radical interpretation, Vinny. but the only point that I could make from that is that in order to get stuff done, you do need to have the power of some kind of power of persuasion, some kind of profile, like any political group, you know, you're not going to get anywhere just by delivering pamphlets in a single car park in Mount Maunganui or something. You know, you've got to get together some kind of, it takes time and it takes people and it takes work for you to make an impression in anything of this kind of political nature. And the only reason we are being sued for defamation is because we're just the little people, or we were the little people, and our aim as a group is to be, is not just the little people, but to be something that is formidable for Joe Karam to have to deal with. And I might just point out here that this defamation suit is double standards, and that Paul Holmes, who, for the American listeners, Paul Holmes was a major anchor, television anchor, who had his own show after the Daily News 5 nights a week. He wrote in a major article on the biggest newspaper in the country that Joe Karam was obsessed, because Joe Karam befriended Paul Holmes, and it was largely due to this friendship that Joe Karam's books sold so well, because they were promoted on this high-profile show. And now Paul Holmes spent time with him. Oh, we off again, are we?
Yeah, we'll be back from break in just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I've always said, you know, it's a tangled web we weave. Oh, a tangled, tangled web indeed. We'll be right back. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. Don't touch that dial. I'm joking. Oh, by the way, Vic, you got to turn your speakers down a little bit there, bro. Sorry about that, folks. Feedback. All right, anyway, we're talking about David Bain and Joe Karam and psychopathy and scumbaggery and all these other certain lovely things that everybody wants to listen to on a Sunday morning or what have you, you know, when they've got some free time. Yes, I'll just look over the paper. Now, here's another question, another angle that I wanted to talk into. You know, my opinion of the media should be quite obvious at this point. So I was wondering, in Joe Karam's case against Robin Bain that he committed the murder, I was wondering what motive and terrible consequence did reading the morning's newspaper shillery actually have, and did that drive him to murder his family? God, this news is crap! They're lying to me! I'm going to kill my entire family! It may have. Maybe.
I think the guy, I think he was having trouble doing the crossword.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just annoyed him, huh?
Yeah. I mean, seriously. It must have been six down. or is it, you know, number six down, to kill or to maim family members?
Yeah.
Well, apparently, according to Joe Karam, the father, Robin Bain, was depressed and down and out. He'd been rejected from the house because he was living in a caravan. And Karam's story is that he kind of lost it and committed the murders because he was dysfunctional. But then
was he having any mental problems or going to a psychiatrist or anything?
No, there was no recorded visits to psychologists or seeking help from doctors or anything. Nothing. He was working full time as a headmaster of a primary school, but of a two.
The headmaster of the primary school.
Well, it was only about two teacher school, so it wasn't a big school. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm just getting warnings from Skype. Maybe someone's interfering. Yeah, never mind.
Must be Mr. Karam, you know, calling in. But by the way, ladies and gentlemen, the call-in number is...
oh, yes.
Yeah. I was just joking. The New Zealanders can't really call in because it's a pretty expensive international call. And because we have a monopolistic mega corporation called Telecom here, international calls and basically calls of any kind, especially to cell phones, are prohibitively expensive.
Yeah. Well, anyway... in Karam's latest book, it appears that he's kind of discarding the evidence and wanting people to focus on the personality of Robin Bain. So he's painted this psychological profile of Robin Bain of just being a dead sitter for this kind of familiar side, if you like.
He'd already been rejected, kind of thing, and now he had his own space. In my experience, when people get rejected from a house and start giving their own space, they actually balance out a little bit because they don't have to deal with the crap that everybody else was giving them for a much larger degree.
Yeah, well, yes and no. The thing is that that there's really no substance for all these stories. Like I say, there's no medical history. There are only anecdotes from people, and of course, some of the anecdotes were that he was fine. He was kind-natured. He was a pacifist. He would never have hurt a fly. Someone at the school wanted him to shoot a pest that had been caught either in a cage or in a trap, and he refused to do so because he was a pacifist. And here he is being accused of mass murder, but if you go around just relying on anecdotal evidence, you know, you can cook up whatever kind of impression you like of somebody. You know, Vinny, I could think of, you know, I could find some stories about you, and before long I could just write a total diatribe about you being I won't say it, but, you know, don't look so expressionless. But you know what I mean? So it's all rumour, innuendo, it's spin, propaganda. It's trying to, it's like when, if propaganda, if you want, if you're waging a war, then you spread posters and propaganda about your enemy and vilifying the enemy, and you make everybody hate the enemy. And this is the kind of thing that is happening with Joe Karam's depiction of Robin Bain. He just wants to create a picture. You know, if you can accuse him of incest, then therefore someone who commits incest must also be a murderer, and so on and so forth. I know you want to say something.
Well, I was wondering about any outside forces. I mean, could it have been neither David or Robin? Was there anybody else with motives against the family or any of the family members?
Well, that's been rejected.
And I honestly think... I think if that was the case, that would be the focus of Mr. Curran's case. There isn't any evidence to suggest that someone else was involved.
Yeah. No extra boot prints. No extra fingerprints that are non-identifiable. No. Yeah. Everybody's dead. The guy who allegedly did it, Robin Bain, winds up killing himself in a feat of yoga, and pardon the pun. And the guy who is still got everybody else's blood on him didn't do it and was just magically home after his paper run. Yeah, right. See, this is interesting, isn't it? But I've always seen the justice system as the one getting off the guilty parties are the ones who get off the crimes, and the innocent parties are always the ones that go down for it. Like that's essentially always been the justice system's perception for me ever since my first brush with it in FSAC 04 or 2004, because it finds out a way of making a story fit into their initial assumption. Basically, that's what the police do. It's because, I don't know why they do that kind of thing. Maybe it's because that's how you convict people, because it's usually pretty obvious. Like, for example, a guy drenched in everybody's blood, ergo, he fracking killed them. I would have thought that were pretty straightforward.
But the police's initial assumption...
Go ahead.
Well, the police's initial assumption was that it was a murder-suicide. And it wasn't until they looked at all the evidence that they decided to charge David. So their initial assumption was that it was a murder-suicide.
Yeah. So their first suspect was Robin. And then they said, oh, well, no, actually, can't have been. It must have been David. And David set it up, put the... By chance, was there blood on the keyboard?
No.
Of that computer, no blood on the keyboard. So David might not have been tested.
No, he'd had a shower by then, because according to the scenario that he'd killed them before he went on the paper run, he had a shower, then he came back and killed his father, and he would have been clean by then.
What about keystroke? Like every computer kind of keeps a log of keystrokes when the keys are hit or whatever.
This is an old computer, but. They couldn't find any identifiable fingerprints on the keyboard.
So even the killer wiped the keyboard down? Oh, come on.
No, it's possible.
Well, I don't.
You don't actually leave fingerprints on a keyboard necessarily.
Really?
Because you're not holding it. You're just putting your finger on it lightly. There's not enough time for an impression. There has to be... I'm not a forensic scientist, but...
But in short, did they even dust the keyboard for prints at all?
Yeah, they looked at it. They just didn't think that there would be anything, because they had a lot of evidence to deal with as it was.
I would have thought that having who was the last person that touched the keyboard would have been a dead giveaway who wrote that message.
Yeah, but there was no evidence they could identify, so that was out.
Shame. It's a shame.
But, you know, like... I described all the evidence that was found at the scene. So in order for Joe Karam to try to make David look innocent and Robin look guilty, he had to go through each item of evidence and come up with an explanation. Like, he claimed that David's fingerprints on the gun were from a previous hunting expedition. So we would have to be led to believe that this rifle, which was used to kill five people, one in a vigorous fight, retained some fingerprints from a previous use. Another thing he did was he accused one policeman of perjury in relation to, I mentioned the broken glasses with the glasses lens in the younger brother's room.
And the rest of the glasses in David's room?
Yeah, the rest of the glasses. Well, what happened was, he accused a policeman of perjury in relation to the position that the policeman identified where the lens was. And he created a big hubbub about this, that it obfuscated the fact that the lens was found there in the room, and so people couldn't see it anymore, you know what I mean? So it kind of like, there was so much controversy over the policeman allegedly lying about where it was positioned that everybody kind of forgot that, yeah, it was found there. Didn't matter where it was positioned, but that glasses lens was still found in there. And so that piece of evidence became obfuscated and people didn't give it any weight anymore, especially the jury. And then he explained everything. He explained the bloody prints on the washing machine to be the result of David picking up Robin's blood-soaked clothes, because according to their scenario, Robin changed his bloody clothes, put them in the washing machine, which David conveniently picked them up as he normally did every morning to do his washing and put them in the machine, obviously not noticing that they were covered in blood. And so that was the explanation for his bloody fingerprint mark on the washing machine. And he explained the fact that the gun and gloves belonged to David as just simply that Robin had gone into David's room and got the gun and got David's gloves, even though Robin had a very similar set of gloves himself in his caravan. So according to their story, he walked past his own set of gloves, went to David's room, got his gloves, yet this is the same person who supposedly wrote a suicide note saying that David was the only one who deserved to stay.
And yet the evidence indicates here he is trying to frame him.
Well, the evidence just indicates that...
You're the only one who deserved to survive, but in prison for the rest of your life!
Yeah, it just indicates it can't have been Robin. There's so many bits. And, like, you know, we're only giving you really... We've only got the time to give you a fraction of the kinds of things which have come out as a result of this case.
Is there anything that perhaps hasn't come out yet or is extra juicy that you've been afraid to say somewhere else? Because this is the place where you can say anything. No taboo topics.
Well, there is. Since the retrial in 2009, a new witness has come forward with testimony, which we have published on the site, so we're not scared. And but I don't think Joe Karen really wants too many people to see this testimony. And this testimony is, again, it's hearsay, and it comes from the eldest sister, and the testimony indicates that David might have been the one who was molesting the girls in the family or abusing them in some way. And also that David was manipulative and controlling, and the girls were scared of him. The two sisters were scared of him. Like, they were 17 and 19, and he was 22. Of course, he's a male, and he's extremely fit. He used to run his paper round. And so that's a new bit of evidence, and that evidence has been put forward to the judge who is investigating the compensation bid. So it should be available.
Well, an interesting trait in serial killers is suffering sexual abuse as children.
Yeah, well, those are
like Manson, Bundy, those kind of really, really big, top, scary type of serial killers who wear women's heads as a hat and such. That's one of the common traits. And so did David by chance experience much abuse, physical, sexual, or otherwise, as a child in this household at all?
No, as far as we know, they had the family life was very happy. Both parents were pacifists, but they did tend to not admonish their children, and that they were kind of hippies in a way. They lived in Papua New Guinea for a while, and during that time, their household was shambolic. The kids did what they liked. But there were some unusual characteristics which stem from the mother, in that the children were suckled till quite a old age.
But we'll talk about more of this after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Yep. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. You can listen live in the chat room there. Also, after the show, you'll be able to access the archives probably later on during the day at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com as well. Back in a minute.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky.
Shadow coming over the sky.
Black sunrise,
in the form of a defamation suit. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. It'll be just, you know, the opposite of preface, you know, just cover my, a CMA, a cover my ass policy. Everything that I've said on this show has to have the tagline, allegedly. So that way, it's just an allegation. It doesn't necessarily mean to be true, because I haven't technically looked it into the evidence, so my opinion doesn't count, obviously. Now, speaking of evidence that doesn't count, there's some strange goings on afoot. You know, who is David Bain? He apparently didn't have very many friends in high school, and when he tried university, he failed it majorly. He's turned down jobs. He's just kind of sitting at home. There's allegedly some kind of terrible family situation, being a bit manipulative, being a bit overbearing, perhaps even hearsay about sexual manifestations or what have you with the sisters. So there's a lot of freaky kind of stuff going on there, but is it all just hearsay? And more to the point, legally speaking, what exactly is hearsay? What's the definition?
Hearsay? You want definition of hearsay from non-legal people?
Sure. Best people that are qualified to do it.
Hearsay is where you have a witness who heard or saw someone else do or say something. So
okay.
it's normally say something. So if you heard your neighbour say that, I don't know.
There was some fiddling going on or whatever. If you heard your neighbour say that to somebody else, whereas that's hearsay. But if your neighbour actually said it to you, that's eyewitness reporting, yes?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Yep, you got it.
All right. Fair enough. Easy peasy. So it can. So ergo, hearsay is excluded as real evidence, isn't it?
Well, apparently there was a change to the Evidence Act 5 years ago or so, where previously there were big restrictions on it, and then prior to the Bain retrial, those restrictions were removed, so that this hearsay evidence could actually be used. And now that you mention it, in the Bain case, the hearsay evidence about incest between Robin Bain and it was the youngest daughter was provided by a witness who the first judge in the trial in 1994 considered to be unreliable. And so the evidence wasn't heard. And this evidence became one of the subjects which gained the retrial. And for the retrial, we understand that the same witness was called, and due to their reliability, they didn't turn up. And
the unreliable witness didn't turn up to give their hearsay evidence. Who saw that coming?
No, well, that's right. But the unfortunate thing and controversial thing that happened was the judge in the retrial actually read out the testimony that this unreliable witness had made in 1994-95. He read it out in the trial, which many consider gave that evidence much greater weight than should have, because the judge read it out.
Okay, so the judge read out a statement for a witness
that was unreliable and who didn't turn up for the retrial.
Fracking kidding me? I mean, come on. Well, wait, hold on a second. This is just the New Zealand court system. Silly me. You know.
Well, there was a lot of pressure on on the court, on the justice system made by Joe Karam and his campaign. And that pressure was the result of Joe Karam made a request for a pardon, which got turned down. He made an appeal, which got turned down. He made another appeal, which got turned down. He then took it to the Privy Council in London at the cost of $500,000 of our taxpayer money to take it to London. They deliberated it over for a week, gave the New Zealand justice system a little whack on the hand. Sorry, gross miscarriage of justice. You should have given this case a retrial and one of the appeals. So by the time of the retrial, the justice system was smarting, basically, from all the pressure that had been brought to bear upon it by this campaign. And they kind of, like, folded, and they made things easy.
Can I ask you, does this campaign treat everybody the way it treats you guys? You know, defamation suits, harassment, threats of violence, abusive letters, messages, and including some of which you've already received for coming on this radio broadcast. Is that the way everybody gets treated?
Well, we don't know for sure.
Well, I hope not.
Anybody who questions it to a great degree and is actually really curious about it. I mean, I'm acting under the assumption that this is not an isolated case whatsoever, and there's numerous cases exactly like this where people have questioned the evidence openly, publicly, as we're allowed to do because we have free speech in this country, and then just had the hail of bricks come down on them.
I thought we had free speech in this country. Now, I'm not a person who's controversial. When I do a lot of blogging, you know, comments on blogs, and I'm kind of a mild-mannered person. I don't get in there and pick a fight. I put my arguments in there, and so I'm not the kind of person who normally attracts this kind of response. But the fact that I've been sued and that it's going to cost me money and time and effort. Now I am committed to going through and defending what I've said down to the end. And I also believe that, as Vic pointed out before, is that this defamation suit doesn't just apply to me, because in internet law there are no precedents in place, or not many, very few, for public discussion forums, Facebook, or your own website, which can be used to know what your position is. And we, assuming that we have our court case, then we'll be setting some of these precedents. So those of you listening who might be running your own boards or forums or what have you, and maybe you're in New Zealand or maybe not, that if you could help contribute to our defence by going to the Counterspin website. There's a donate button there, and you can donate using PayPal, or if you're in New Zealand, well, you don't have to be. You can donate direct deposit to our bank account. And so we hope to successfully defend the claim against us, but also to put in place some kind of precedent so that other people who like to speak up politically can have some kind of legislation in place.
Now, do you want to seek, like, let's say, for example, you're one of many cases that Joe Karam is taking defamation suits against, right? Now, considering the timing, the time that it takes, the stress, the toll that it takes, and the money, the toll that it takes, do you think that just like him and David Bain, you should be able to seek compensation if you win from Joe Karam?
No, there's never any. That's not the way it works. When you defend it, it's going to, even if we succeed, it still costs money. So most people.
Okay, so he can get compensation for allegedly murdering a family and going to jail for it, but you can't get compensation against a frivolous defamation suit that basically destroys your life and your finances. Is that about right?
Well, A, if it's vexatious, we can get money back. That's only vexatious if he withdraws it, and we can get back our. We can get back our costs, but nothing more. In New Zealand law, you can't get anything more than costs, and even then, you may not may only get 75% of it. And the other thing is that...
And who pays that?
Well, he does.
Okay.
But the other thing is that I'm not actually extremely stressed out about it. It's, I find it quite
Well, you're confident actually. Because you... You're confident because you think you've got the truth and the evidence on your side, right?
Well, I would never have spoken out in the first place if I didn't feel I had that.
We have got the truth. I honestly think, well, we wouldn't be speaking out if we didn't think this was the truth. We would have just crawled under a rock and let him go and walk away from it. It's blaming his... Well, on my part of it, it's blaming that other person, blaming his father like that. It's just... Well, it's just... I can't think of a word for it. It's just too disgusting for words for me.
It's reprehensible and opportunistic.
In other words, it's made you a bit livid.
Very livid. I mean, he's just gutless. You know, I mean, he's never came out and stood up for his father. Even if he was to come out and say, I didn't realise my father was this ill or something, you know? But he hasn't said anything like that.
Sometimes...
If it was his father, he hasn't even come out and said anything to defend his mother or his sister or his brother, you know? What about them? They're the innocent people in this, in a big way, but they're all innocent. You know?
Have you noticed how when people get murdered, it all becomes about the murderer and they forget about the victims?
Well, those were good people. Well, that girl, the oldest girl, was the head girl at her school, you know? She was the head girl at her school, and that says, you know, you don't get there for being a scumbag. And if you look on YouTube, there's a Brian Bruce, the famous reporter in New Zealand, has just put a clip on YouTube about Robin Bain, and it shows you the people that knew him, not people that are getting his second hand like Mr. Karam. These are people that actually worked and knew Robin Bain, and he was a good man.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you'll be surprised how often it's surprising how often lies can be used to pin a horrible crime on an innocent man. And it's surprising how truth can shatter a thousand lies. Thanks very much, guys, for joining me here today. You can go to counterspin.co.nz and contribute to their defense if you can. Other than that, please share this interview far and wide, because the truth should get out there and people should be able to make up their minds based on solid evidence. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.